Talking History with Patrick Gagan. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auchtereuen, Argus.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. 250 years ago, Thomas Jefferson and others changed the world by writing the American Declaration of Independence, and few words have shaped modern politics more profoundly. Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, 250 years on, we're going to explore the impact and legacy of the American Declaration of Independence in the United States and around the world. And we'll explore whether the vision of a new world based on life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness was ever achievable. You can send us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. The Declaration of Independence announced the birth of a new nation, but it also proclaimed universal principles that have inspired revolutions, reformers, and freedom movements around the world. But it has always carried profound contradictions. How could a document declaring that all men are created equal emerge from a society built upon slavery? And so, 2.5 centuries later, we're exploring how it remains a document at the centre of debates about democracy, citizenship, equality, and the meaning of America itself. And so, to help me explore the origins, language, global impact, and contested legacy of the American Declaration of Independence, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Stephanie McCurry is the Professor of U.S. History at Columbia University and is an expert on the American Civil War. And she was in Dublin during this week to speak on the legacy of the Declaration of Independence at the Trinity Long Room Hub. Professor Elijah Gould is a leading expert on the American Revolution. He's currently the Harmsworth Professor of American History at Queen's College, the University of Oxford, and is Professor of History at the University of New Hampshire. And his books include Among the Powers of the Earth, The American Revolution, and The Making of a New World Empire. Professor Kathleen Burke is Emerita Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, an expert on Anglo-American relations, finance, and foreign policy. She's the author of The Line and the Eagle, The Interaction of the British and American Empires, as well as Old World, New World, The Story of Britain and America. Well, you're all very welcome. And Stephanie, I might begin with you and a question about this document, this text, probably being the most iconic document in the history of the United States, one of the most impactful, and some of the most iconic lines in American history.
Well, that's for sure. I actually think about it as kind of the American creed. Like, no matter what happens to it in any political moment, it's going to survive. It's still going to be the touchstone of American life, an aspiration to American life. It's taken a lot of damage over the years, but it's still standing, and that all men are created equal with these inherent rights. But the other interesting thing to say maybe at the beginning is the inherent rights aren't, they're a little bit, they sound a little bit modern, right? The pursuit of happiness. Like, if you asked us what's the pursuit of happiness, you'd get a million different answers. It's an interesting question to think about what that meant in 1776. I mean, maybe Elijah has a really sharp answer to that, but when I teach it, I always talk about how it's not a life, liberty, and the pursuit of property, which was would have been the more Lockean approach to the social contract, but it's certainly United States is, as we all know, committed to the pursuit of property. But the pursuit of happiness, I think, in time and place was more of this Scottish Enlightenment philosophy of people who constitute government and pursue the common good in the interests of the communal whole. I know I'm curious about what Elijah thinks about that.
Well, Elijah, let's bring you in on that, because it does sound slightly self-indulgent now, maybe to a 21st century audience and perhaps a non-American audience who wouldn't have grown up with those lines. The pursuit of happiness. It seems like perhaps you should be pursuing bigger concepts.
Right. Yeah. It did not mean watching football on a Sunday afternoon. I mean, I think what Stephanie said is absolutely right. And I think there is a very powerful Scottish influence here, Scottish Enlightenment. I think the thing I would add is, I mean, the one explanation for why the switch from property to happiness is that property is very agrarian, and it denotes land. It's rooted in a particular moment. Happiness can include property, but it can also include commerce. And I think they're conscious very much of being a commercial people. They one of the things they wanted, they kind of got, was to resume trade with Britain once the war was over. And that's all part of happiness. And I think the other thing to bear in mind is that to an 18th century mind today, I think we think of commerce and capitalism and something very self-interested, which it is. But commerce was also understood as conferring wider benefits. The French talk about du commerce, that is the softening effects of commerce. So that an age of commercial happiness tends to be a more humanitarian age, an age where people are actually kinder to each other, an age where people keep their promises the way merchants do. I mean, we also know, of course, the commercial age would impoverish people. It drives the slave trade. But when they write those words, in a positive sense, they're thinking of the good things that commerce brings. And they thought of those as communal goods.
Kathy, how shocking was the declaration from a British perspective? Because the war had been going on. And I wonder, did people in Britain believe that the revolution could actually succeed? And then suddenly on the 4th of July, you have the publication of this revolutionary document.
Well, it depends on who you're talking about in Britain, of course, because during the whole period, the United Colonies had support in Britain. And there was quite a liberal group, both outside and inside Parliament, that supported the Americans, or at least supported an easier way of treating the Americans. Of course, the British were a bit surprised, shall we say, when they heard of the declaration, which took a while, and they were already embodied in, engaged in conflict, in a sense, with both the French and the Spanish. And therefore, indeed, they'd been, the years thus far in the 18th century, they'd been at war with France for 49 of them. And a declaration of independence in Britain, which means even more of a problem, means it is going to be more of a problem with us elsewhere. Because I don't know whether Stephanie and Elijah agree with me, but it seems to me that one of the main reasons there was a declaration of independence was because the United Colonies were going to need help, ideally France if they could, and if they couldn't face them as a sovereign state in a sense, they weren't going to get help, because no country was going to give aid to what could be seen as a rabble.
And Elijah, that very much connects with your work on this being a diplomatic document as well as a revolutionary radical document. And in a way, the declaration was showing the world that the colonies were treaty worthy. They were deserving of an agreement or some kind of treaty that would give them that international recognition and support.
No, that's absolutely right. And as Kathleen suggests, it's... The declaration is inward facing. All men are created equal has been so important to American democracy. But in many ways, its primary goal is to appeal to the world. And of course, the part of the world they're thinking of in particular is France. And to Kathleen's point, Britain and the Americans together had been fighting against France and Spain for the better part of a century. And the idea that Britain would lose the United Colonies and that they become the United States and ally with France is terrifying, but that is in fact what the Declaration seeks to do. At the same time that the Committee of Five is drafting the Declaration, Franklin and Adams and three other committee members were drawing up a model treaty that is an example of the treaty that they hoped France would sign once independence was declared. So yes, this is very much an international diplomatic document. And of course, it terrifies the British.
Well, Elijah, maybe let's talk about that Committee of Five and maybe the actual drafting, because you've added some complications to the story now. Because even though there was that, you know, committee and the people working on it, and there was, I think, a lot of editing of Jefferson's draft, this really is Thomas Jefferson's document, isn't it?
Well, yes. The late historian Pauline Mayer wrote a terrific book on the Declaration of Independence. The draft was Jefferson's. There are some famous things that were taken out of it. He, for example, blamed Britain for the slave trade. He talked about Scottish mercenaries. John Witherspoon, a Scottish member of Congress, said, you know, Mr. Jefferson, you might not want to irritate the Scots. There are a lot of them fighting for Congress right now. So, but yeah, it is Jefferson's document. There were amendments and everything, but a lot of this is Jefferson's vision.
And then it gets signed by very many people, including some with strong Irish connections and some born in Ireland. And John Hancock is the giant signature on it. And that goes into the popular culture then and the lexicon that put your signature on something, give us your John Hancock.
That's correct. So, although interestingly, occasionally hear people say signed on July 4th. It's not signed on July 4th. I think Hancock puts his signature on it, but it takes the better part of a month or more for everyone to sign it. An interesting sort of side issue, side note there is, the version that was published on July 4th by a Philadelphia printer named John Dunlop is published without the signatures. There is a second authorized printing in January of 1777 that does have the signatures. That is produced by a female printer named Mary Catherine Goddard, who is the Postmaster General. She's a woman, and she's the Postmaster General of Baltimore. But that's the first one with the signatures, and it's printed by a woman, which is a kind of a fun factoid.
And Elijah, the language itself, some of those phrases, I think they're remembered because it's an iconic document and it's declaring independence and independence is achieved, it's studied. But some of the lines, I think, are remembered because they are so beautifully written. They're somewhat enigmatic, they're striking. They do capture the imagination. They're written and phrased in a way that they are memorable. We hold these truths to be self-evident. You know, there's 100 different ways you could have phrased that sentence, and perhaps you could have done it in a clearer way or an easier way, but not as striking a way. And the talk about inalienable rights, and even then the putting the three ideas together, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, there's a rhythm there. There's a beauty there that the language itself is really quite powerfully phrased, and going beyond the ideas and the sentiments, that really succeeds.
Oh, it does. There's actually a wonderful article. It's an old article. It's actually on the U.S. National Archives website with the Declaration, talking about the Declaration as a work of rhetoric. And the author talks about how it works as a rhetorical and legal document. It then proceeds to the 27 grievances against the king, which have made him unfit to be the ruler of a free people, another beautifully wrought line. And then it closes with the conclusion. And in that conclusion, for my own work, I find it particularly evocative and fascinating, where having accused the king of all these things, the Declaration then says, "And our British brethren have refused to stand up to him. Therefore, we are also severing the ties with them." But it says, "But once this is over, we will treat them as we treat the rest of the world, enemies in war, in peace, friends. And that wonderful chiasmus I think it's actually a very hopeful way to end. We're at war now, but we will be friends again once this is over.
And that piece you referenced, it's Stephen E. Lucas's, well worth reading on the archives.gov website. And Kathy, it's interesting what Elijah says there about the attacks on George III, because again, maybe we tend to focus on the opening sections and not on that. It is very effective political propaganda, because it is very much framing who is the bad guy here, what has gone wrong, who's the cause of all of this trouble. And it's very good in framing the narrative of the conflict.
Well, there's a couple of things, if I may say. First of all, in terms of the rhetoric, I think we have to remember that Jefferson could be very verbose. And a lot of the, some of the significant phrases were actually added by Franklin and the other members of the committee. And also that there were dozens of independence things. This was not the only one. And a lot of the phrases came from writings of a man called George Mason. So I think that although it sounds like it's Jefferson, of course it is. He's the first draft. But they took out a quarter of it, in fact, took out the whole section on slavery and so forth. Mostly, attacks beforehand had been on the ministers, not the king, but his bad counsel and so forth. This had been a traditional sort of thing. And I think your point about the attack on the king was a new one, in fact. And you've got someone you can actually blame. How can you blame a people? It's even difficult to blame Parliament because they had real support there. But if you can focus on one man, this makes it, in certain senses, a lot easier to sell, both to the domestic audience, of course, and to the British audience. And indeed, George III was going to spend a lot of time actually focusing on what was going on in the United States. It became clearer and clearer that he could be blamed in many respects, because he didn't have to do the things that were suggested to him. He decided that declaration made the United Colonies a true enemy of Britain, and therefore he would treat them nicely once they'd come back under his ambit.
Stephanie, when Abraham Lincoln delivered his Gettysburg Address, again, one of the most iconic texts in American history, he doesn't frame it around the Constitution. Instead, he looks back to the Declaration. And again, in that beautifully poetic and striking way, he doesn't say 87 years ago the Declaration was made. He says 87. And again, you know, it kind of almost gives it this biblical feeling to the language. But it shows for a later president going through one of the greatest crises the United States had ever faced or has ever faced, the Declaration of Independence, despite its flaws or despite what it doesn't include, is a guiding, shining document.
That's absolutely true. And in fact, when my friends here on the show were talking about the language of the Declaration, I think there's really direct parallels, or maybe even straight up evoking the pacing of the Declaration in the Gettysburg Address. There's a lot of three-word phrases, the pacing, the syncopation of the thing. It's 280 words long. It's tiny, right? It took 2 minutes to deliver. It was over before anybody knew he'd started talking in the crowd. And it's a stunning, it's incredibly moving. Like when I teach it, I have to control myself. It's a very emotional statement. And the thing is that I think by the time this happened in 1863, the Confederacy had existed for 2 years. Pro-slavery people had basically put the boots to the concept of the Declaration all in those intervening years. And he comes and he literally takes it out of the wreckage of slavery. He lifts it up. And for him, it's the document. You know, he reveres the Declaration of Independence. To him, it's the founding document, not the Constitution, which was like a compact working out, balancing all these lobbying interests, different competing interests. To him, this is just this beacon of light. And it's a beacon of light for two reasons. One is what he calls the new birth of freedom. So he's re-signifying the all men are created equal to say definitively, and given yesterday's decision in the birthright decision, this is crucial. He's saying, all men are created equal, we mean all human beings. The clarification of that, the what had clouded the Declaration all through its life up to that point. And he says, what we have sacrificed here for, what these men have died for, is a new birth of freedom. And he's really signifying the Declaration there. And it's just, it really is an act of recovery and resignification. And for him, this is the most important thing of all. It's we, and his commitment thereafter to black soldiers, to black liberty, he pushes through the 13th Amendment, not just him, obviously, the Republicans. But it's this, it was the, you know, basically he picked up and carried on what had been a very, a black abolitionist tradition through most of the antebellum period. And it was, you know, incredible also in the sense of how he carried public opinion with him. So something that a couple of years before, I mean, at the so the Gettysburg Address has a couple of principles. I've already talked about the new birth of freedom, the end of slavery. But the other one is the defense of the Union. That, to him, is not just about the Union. It's about government by the people, for the people. It's about democracy. And he said, we can't let this republic fail, because if we let this Union, this republic, fail, then democracy itself has failed, government by the people, and the whole world will know. And that goes back, I think, to the Declaration, right? I mean, why did they declare a republic and not a constitutional monarchy or some other form? Republics didn't have a great lifespan or a great reputation at that point. And so, and it had been a precarious republic, right? It had been riven from the start. It actually fell apart. I mean, a civil war, you know, despite the rhetoric of the Brothers' War, the United States was two countries at one point. So the reunification language makes it all seem inevitable. Oh, we had this rift, we had this fraternal struggle, but it was inevitable. That is not true. They were two countries, and there were lots of people invested in the Confederate States of America and the perpetual lifetime of enslavement for people of African descent. So Lincoln is doing at least two major things there. He's defending the principle of the Declaration of Independence, and he's defending the principle of the consent of the governed, that this is the only way people, the government should work, is with the consent of the people. And we're the test in the world of that. We are, not anybody else. We're the democracy, and if we fail, it fails. And it works. I mean, it has it works as a rhetoric. It works as a to build popular consent. In 1860, Lincoln didn't stand for the end of slavery. He stood for the limitation of slavery's expansion. And it's really amazing. Like, I'm not a person to hero worship, but if you watch how he evolved in the crisis of the war, you know, and you think about the kind of leadership we have now, I think, you know, it's just kind of staggering to think that a person was capable of that kind of political growth and personal growth to come to the position where it was all staked on the end of slavery. And only this could be worthy of the sacrifice of human life, you know, 800,000 dead. So, yeah, it's a pretty amazing 280 words.
And when we come back after the break, we will explore the contradictions around slavery during the revolutionary period and with the Declaration. But despite what Lincoln says, and despite seeing the Declaration as a beacon of light, the great Irish leader Daniel O'Connell, who was a leading abolitionist, he offended Americans by attacking the Declaration. He would very publicly call it a hypocritical document because it has that sentence that all men are created equal. And he would say, but they're not, because of the sin of slavery. And I wonder, we will explore it, but is there a kind of a tension there? Because despite saying that and declaring that, it isn't true for more than the 67 years.
No, that's completely right. I mean, I think it's impossible to treat this document, Jefferson himself, or the birth of the Republic, without a central focus on this tension that was, it's not just a tension, it's an utter contradiction to the principle. And that's the fight that I think is the definitive fundamental argument in American history is, are we all created equal? What does that mean? What rights and freedoms are guaranteed to people who are regarded as part of the people? And, you know, that's a question about race and slavery. It's a question about gender and men and women. It's a question about equality of opportunity and property and, you know, human rights. And Jefferson knew it was a question of human rights. He used that term. He knew slavery was a moral crime. I mean, we can talk about that more. I'm convinced of this. I mean, there are many people who would say that when Jefferson said all men are created equal, nobody meant black men. This is the Taney decision in Dred Scott in 1857. I think that's untrue. I think he did mean all human beings. He couldn't deal with the contradict. He couldn't figure out. He could never put slavery right in his own mind, but he also couldn't find a way out of it. And personally, he was a disaster on this question. He owned 600 people over the course of his life, including six of his own children. The mother of them, he never freed. I mean, this guy was a walking moral catastrophe. And that's a real problem because he did write the Declaration of Independence. But I don't think you square that circle by saying, well, he only meant all white men. I don't think you can do that. I think it's actually more interesting than that.
Well, we're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the American Declaration of Independence. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we're going to talk about the contradictions at the heart of the document. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the American Declaration of Independence. My brilliant panel of experts, Professor Stephanie Curry, who's Professor of U.S. History at Columbia University. She's an expert on the American Civil War, and her books include Women's War, Fighting and Surviving the American Civil War. Professor Elijah H. Gould is a leading expert on the American Revolution, and he's currently the Harmsworth Professor of American History at the Queen's College at the University of Oxford, and is Professor of History at the University of New Hampshire, and his books include Among the Powers of the Earth, the American Revolution and the Making of a New World Empire. Professor Kathleen Burke is Emerita Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, is an expert on the Anglo-American relations and finance and foreign policy, and her books include The Lion and the Eagle, The Interaction of the British and American Empires, as well as Old World, New World, The Story of Britain and America. Elijah, can we talk about slavery, and can we talk about the contradictions there at the heart of the Declaration of Independence, that it proclaims that all men are created equal, but yet there are all of these tensions and arguments, there's contradictions, as we've heard, in Jefferson's approach and his views on the whole thing. But it seems to, I don't know, it seems to pull apart at the strength of the document when there are all of these unresolved issues.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree with that. And I would second everything Stephanie said before the break. A couple of observations, and they're somewhat contradictory themselves. First, one of the things that strikes me about the Declaration, and I actually sort of, this came to me in teaching it at the University of New Hampshire, is it is clear, and yet there's oftentimes an ambiguity there. This is a declaration on behalf of 13 states. And in 1776, there was more than just two nations. Each one of these states had its own approach to the contradictions in the Declaration on religion, who could vote, who couldn't, how broadly the franchise would be constructed, and of course, slavery. So, you know, I think the ambiguity is one of the things that made it work, but the hypocrisy of slavery was there from the beginning. And it used to be, actually not so long ago, historians would say, well, it's only gradually that all men are created equal became a problem. And, you know, oftentimes it's sort of Frederick Douglass, the lead up to the Civil War, Lincoln, where that was assumed to become prominent. In fact, we know that African Americans from the get-go focused on that. The famous example is Lemuel Haynes, a black Minuteman from Massachusetts, who wrote an essay, Liberty Further Extended, during the summer of 1776, the summer or fall, in which he focuses on those words. Elizabeth Freeman, who files the freedom suit in 1783 that leads to the abolition of slavery. Excuse me, she's 1781. She invokes those words. So blacks and are focusing on that contradiction from the beginning. So it's there very much at the beginning. And I agree. I think Jefferson knew exactly what a moral quandary this was. And it's broadly shared. One of the things that strikes me is the propensity of the founding generation to acknowledge the slavery, the hypocrisy of slavery. And it's acknowledged by the opponents of slavery as a way to drive a wedge and force governments to do something about it. It also, though, becomes a way to excuse doing nothing about it, because, of course, saying you're a hypocrite can be a way of excusing what you're doing. Henry Lawrence famously invokes hypocrisy in that way. He writes his son during the summer of 1776, and he says, "Believe me, my child, my son, if I could free my slaves, I would, but I can't." So hypocrisy becomes a kind of double-edged sword, but everyone acknowledges it.
And Elijah, when he says men, is that just the shorthand that he, you know, in the time, you really mean people, or does he specifically mean I'm really, whatever about the color of their skin, I'm very certain about the gender and I'm talking about men?
Well, if you're talking about Jefferson, perhaps. I'm not a Jefferson scholar. But again, what an author is doing isn't always what he or she or they think they're doing. It's what their readers think they're doing. And we know that in New Jersey, in 1776, the Constitution creates an opening for female property holders, most of them widows. It's not a huge group, but New Jersey allows property-owning women to vote. Abigail Adams, when she's in New York as the second lady of the United States, the wife of the vice president, writes her sister and says, if I lived in New Jersey, I would vote. So, again, whether Jefferson meant to include women or not, there are places in the United States in 1776 where people are thinking in those terms.
Kathy, it's interesting that there are so many tensions over slavery, and tensions then in terms of, but even when you look at the people in the colonies, because I think that's something that's left out of the story, but that your work explores, the fact that there are some who are loyal to the British side and continue to be loyal to the British side. And then there are different and conflicting views about how best to address the challenge of slavery, and whether that's by remaining as part of the British Empire or seeking independence.
Well, it does seem to me that one of the real problems here, and one of the problems particularly in Britain in terms of supporting or not supporting, was what they considered the profound hypocrisy of people yelling for freedom for themselves, but not for their slaves. And this was indeed Samuel Johnson used to rail against this and what the Americans thought they were doing and why they should assume that men in Britain, for example, should have the same striated approach to slavery and what you're going to do about it. And indeed, one difficulty with getting the Declaration through, as it were, was the Southern states. In fact, Jefferson and the others had to tiptoe carefully about that, or they were going to lose one-third of what was then the colonies. So the question of slavery extended beyond the states, if you see what I mean. It did make it difficult for the United Colonies to get support from Britain. Not a problem with France, who didn't really care, but certainly with their own, as what they called their mother country, it was a real problem.
And to what extent, Kathy, would you see this as a civil war as well as a conflict between an emerging nation and an existing power?
Well, in the olden days, when I used to study this as a student and a young lecturer, the assumption was that it was a third. There were a third loyalists who didn't want to leave, a third of what they called themselves the patriots who wanted to leave, and a third who just wanted to be left by themselves, who didn't really support either side, but didn't want to be involved in what would become, you're quite right, a civil war. And it was difficult to unite the country, and indeed the colonies themselves were divided. You know, the New England group, the middle colonies like New York and New Jersey and Pennsylvania, and the southern colonies. And so it was necessary to devise something that would bring together all three. And this was part of the problem with the question of slavery, that it wasn't just that Jefferson had them. It was that if you were going to bring a united approach from all the colonies, you had to tiptoe, because if you lost the Carolinas, for example, or even Virginia, it was going to be difficult. You would not have been able to get foreign aid, and you would find it difficult to cope with this different groups of different states who had different interests themselves and different ideas about what should happen. So that's one of the great outcomes, I think, of all the discussions about the Declaration, is the sheer quality, the ability to put together something that could be, even though none of them would really liked it altogether, they could come together on a basis of an agreed document that didn't attack any one groups of these, but actually were able to bring them all together and agreed, not liked by all of them, but ability to pull themselves together because they knew they had to have it, and this is what gets them involved in due course in the whole balance of power in Europe and the questions of how you get any sort of aid, which they knew was vital. They knew if they didn't have foreign aid, there was nothing they could do about it against Britain, the greatest sea power in the world. And although British ships could not go up the rivers and over the Appalachians, they could destroy the coastal cities, and there goes commerce, and so forth. So therefore, actually being able to bring them together, that to me is one of the real coups of the Founding Fathers, is that they were able to weave together all the different ideas and ideals and requirements and interests behind this, as you've all said, iconic instrument that has not been forgotten. And although I put in a small vote here for also we the people with the Constitution, we the people actually tends to put into rhetoric what it was slightly difficult for the Declaration to do.
Stephanie, I agree with you completely about the Gettysburg Address. And if tonight's show was in some future point for the 250th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address, I think it would be a celebration. It's a profound text. It's a remarkable achievement, and it's such a huge impact. But I don't feel the same for the Declaration. And partly it's because maybe the way it's being celebrated, perhaps uncritically in an uncomplicated way, and perhaps because of the current occupant of the White House, or perhaps because there are all of those tensions that are unresolved in 1776 and for many decades afterwards. And it's problematic, but it's perhaps problematic in a way that isn't always recognized or appreciated.
Well, I agree with you on that. And yet I think I'm a fairly cynical person, materialist, hardcore. And yet I still can get up a cheer for the Declaration of Independence, notwithstanding all the things that we have just said. And in fact, in the United States right now, both as teachers and in public culture, we're being encouraged as too gentle, in some ways legally forced to adopt what the new administration calls a viewpoint neutrality position on things like this. But they would not like us to be talking about the Declaration in the way we just did. And they wouldn't like us to point out, and I think part of it is that the Declaration, as Kathy was just saying, is followed by the Constitution, which becomes the practical working out of all of these competing interests that she laid out. And the Constitution is, in that fight, I think the forces of people who were critical of slavery were there, but the people who were insistent on the defense and protection of slaveholders' interests were an organized power group, far more organized within that body than the anti-slavery people, whose principles were there and curbed, worse outcomes in the Constitution. But from the beginning, those pro-slavery forces were, very powerful in the founding moment between the Declaration and the Constitution. And of course, what happened afterwards is that The irony is that notwithstanding the declaration, and here I think this is viewpoint neutrality, it did say all men are created equal. It opened a pathway that we're still fighting to defend, including in the United States. But on the other hand, when the Revolutionary War was over and independence was won, slavery was far stronger than it was before. And the United States became an incomparably the most powerful slave power in the Western world. So slavery become because of and no small measure because of Jefferson's own decisions as the president to purchase Louisiana, I think what trip a third of the territory of the continental United States, something like that. And so slavery is left in a far stronger position after the founding than it was before. And it's also because it's the only independent slaveholding power in the Western world. They're not a colony anymore. When Britain decides to abolish slavery, it can't touch it in the United States. And by this point, it doesn't even really need the international slave trade. It has a domestic slave trade. There's like a 4 million people of African descent enslaved in the United States by 1860. So this is viewpoint neutrality to say both of these things, to trace out both of these sort of parallel paths through from the document through to the Civil War. And, you know, as Elijah said, one of the streams, really important streams running into the anti-slavery side of this fundamental struggle are black abolitionists themselves organizing through free black people in the North, fugitive slaves who make it to the free states, because there's a whole period of emancipation, you know, from the Freeman, the 1781 petition to the all of the Northern states gradually emancipate enslaved people over a long protracted period of time, but they do it. And that fundamentally changes the United States. So it's both of these things. The other thing about this fight, and not just about slavery, but to which slavery is central, is that slavery comes to secure the credit of the United States abroad. It's the only valuable commodity they have to export. And so it becomes inextricable from the national wealth. And it creates all kinds of other material interests that support it, even down to the big cotton merchants of New York. This is the contradiction.
We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be exploring the legacy and impact of the Declaration of Independence. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are exploring the American Declaration of Independence on this, its 250th anniversary. We have an absolutely stellar panel of experts, Professor Stephanie McCurry of Columbia University, Professor Elijah Gould, who's a leading expert on the American Revolution. He's currently the Harmsworth Professor of American History at the Queen's College at the University of Oxford, and he's Professor of History at the University of New Hampshire, and Professor Kathleen Burke, who's Emerita Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and who is an internationally acclaimed expert on Anglo-American relations, finance and foreign policy. Elijah, can we talk about the immediate impact in terms of international affairs? Because I think it does win over the French. It does help lead to the Treaty of Paris. And it does, I think, resonate in countries around the world. And it continues to do so. And when we see so many later revolutions, you see so many of them having their own declarations of independence, including in this country in Ireland. And they can all trace their origins to that document from 1776.
Yes, it becomes sort of the model for colonized people to declare independence and free themselves from rule by another power. So, yeah, it's hugely important in that regard.
And what about in terms of the immediate effect? Did this win over the French? Because, of course, France at this time was a monarchy itself. And the fact that it intervened in the conflict in 1778 against Britain was hugely significant and impactful. So did it help in that way? You know, in other words, was there a kind of a diplomatic success story attached to the declaration as well?
Yes. So both France and Spain and they're allied in 1776. They both have their kings are part of the same Bourbon royal family. And France and Spain both, as actually before 1776. The fighting started in April of 1775, and they are immediately sending assistance to the, at that point, United Colonies, but it is covert assistance. And one of the big arguments for independence is that Tom Paine makes this argument in Common Sense, the pamphlet that is so important in swinging Americans around to independence in the winter of 1776 when it's published. Paine says, until we are independent, no one will ally with a group of subjects in rebellion against their lawful sovereign. So, yes, it takes another 2 years. In France's case, what had to happen was that the United States, as it now was, needed to show that it really was going to be able to hold its own against Britain militarily. And an army under General Horatio Gates at the Battle of Saratoga in upstate New York proceeded to do that, forced General John Burgoyne to surrender. That happened in the fall or the autumn of 1777. And as soon as it arrived, Benjamin Franklin, already in Paris, begins the process of concluding a formal treaty of alliance with France. So yes, it takes a while, but once Congress had declared independence, it had turned itself into a worthy partner in a treaty with a European power. The other thing I would say about that, Patrick, is that we tend to think of the Declaration of Independence as sufficient. But no one thought that way in 1776. Instead, they recognized that independence was a three-legged stool, a tripod. There needed to be a formal declaration. That happened in 1776. There also needed to be a charter of government, and the first constitution, the Articles of Confederation, was adopted in 1777. But finally, there needed to be a peace treaty with the government from whom Americans were declaring independence, in this case, George III and the British government. And that finally came in 1783, the Treaty of Paris. And together, the Declaration, the Articles of Confederation, later replaced by the Constitution and the Treaty of Paris, create this three-legged support for the sovereignty of the United States.
Kathy, how do you think we should remember the Declaration in this part of the world, in Ireland, in Britain, in Europe, 250 years on? Because we can interrogate it perhaps in a way that can avoid some of the oversimplifications. That how do you think we should remember it, or if we are commemorating it or marking it, how do you think we should view it?
Well, there's two things there. One that we haven't really talked about is the fact that it's entirely caught up on the European balance of power, because Britain, France, and Spain are the three imperial powers, the three sea powers, and they're the powers that are at war, sometimes with each other, sometimes in alliance. So this was the important thing at that period. Nowadays, it doesn't make nearly the impact that it does in the States, because, for one thing, the United States is not in such good view, as has already been emphasized, with the rest of Europe. Those who already have freedom and so forth do not look back on the Declaration of Independence as the signal occasion, the signal document that they look at. It's, and that's more likely to be in some of the countries that are worse off and are under, in a sense, a colonial regime by other sorts of countries, such as, of course, Russia. So I don't think, I mean, yes, the Irish revolutionaries did look at it, but if we're going to talk about what it's like now, does Europe care about it? Obviously, Ireland does, but Ireland was a colony as well, essentially. So they had a fellow feeling I believe, with the United colonies. But the fact that Ireland at that point didn't have much freedom itself at all gave them a fellow feeling. But for the rest of Europe, and I've lived here for decades, it doesn't really get mentioned. So in that sense, although it was one of the major founding documents, although we cannot as well forget, there is the Constitution. It's an icon, but do icons always have relevance to what happens today?
Stephanie, that's a very interesting perspective on it. But I wonder, when you look around the world and you see human rights being eroded and you see human dignity and human life not as respected or valued as it should be, I wonder, you know, can we look back to the Declaration and remind ourselves that all people are created equal, and that there are certain unalienable rights, and that that we can perhaps take some inspiration from these ideas, reaffirm our commitment to those principles and values?
Well, I think it's really interesting what Kathy just said, and it really puts it in light, I think, of this moment in the United States. I mean, I think that's right, that there's a kind of there was a kind of sunsetting of the Declaration of Independence at a certain point. It stays alive in the United States because it's the founding document of the nation, but also because the fundamental fight that it inaugurated is ongoing. So maybe the phrase and the Jefferson and the Declaration itself has kind of curdled on the tongue because of the history that it's attached to and the present situation. But the abstract principle of human equality, I mean, as an Irish person, I have to say the history of this country in the last 50 years is itself astonishing. I don't know that there's anywhere else in the world where the level of social mobility has been reached as in the United States through education and other the lifting of old sectarian, certainly I'm from Belfast, Northern Ireland, so in my generation, what happened to my generation in Northern Ireland is unbelievable. And I think the Republic of Ireland, too, is a kind of testament to change and to moving in a direction of human equality and capacity. So in that sense, can those words ever not be meaningful? We are never going to be done with this question. I don't think that the United States gets to be the clarion call. I think that ship has sailed. But if you can take the words and the principle of the words, I think they can't help but be meaningful.
Well, very powerful and profound words on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to Professor Stephanie McCurry, Professor Elijah Gould, Professor Kathleen Burke. That does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marais O'Sullivan, for bringing everything together. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.